Hi, I'm Chris Klink, and you're listening to my Writing Table Podcast. Liza Nash Taylor, the author of Etiquette for Runways, was a 2018 Hawthornden International Fellow and received her MFA from Vermont College of Fine Arts. The 2016 winner of the San Miguel Writers Conference Fiction Prize, her work has appeared in Mitochondria 2, Gargoyle Magazine, and Deep South, among others. A native Virginian, she lives in Keswick, Virginia, with her husband and dogs.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
Your home served as a setting in your first novel, and it's a pretty interesting location. Can you tell us more?
Sure. It actually is a setting in both of my novels, and the house is called Keswick Farm. It's where I live right now. I've lived here for 25 years, and it's an old Virginia farmhouse that was built about 1825. Never a fancy house at all, but it was added onto over the years, and we did a lot of work on it ourselves when we bought it. And I love houses with history, and this place definitely has some history. When I'm digging around in my garden, I'll find shards of pottery or old horseshoes or bottles and things like that. And it was a piece of broken pottery that actually helped me to define my first main character.
How did that piece of pottery inform you about her?
I just had it here on my desk and I put it away because I showed it to a Facebook group this morning, but it's a piece of a Victorian doll's face that's broken and it's a little bit funky. But when I found it in the dirt, I cleaned it up and I looked at it and I thought, now whose doll was this? And what was that little girl's life like here at this house? And how did the doll get broken? And those questions really sparked the development of the main character in my first book, Etiquette for Runaways. And her name is Mae Marshall, and her story starts here in 1925.
Your latest book, In All Good Faith, came out August 10th. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's a dual narrative, and it's a standalone sequel to Etiquette for Runaways. And it didn't start out to be a dual narrative, though. It started out to continue Mae Marshall Craig's story 6 years later, taking her from Paris in 1925 to Virginia in 1932 in the very bottom of the Great Depression. And I knew I had more of Mae's story to tell, and I sort of had an idea of how her chapters would go. And then this other character sort of popped into my head and wouldn't go away. I've never had that happen. I've heard of other writers who've said that characters have come to them sort of fully formed. And I pushed her aside, and I knew she was a teenager. For some reason, I knew she was from Boston. And then finally, I gave her a name, and that her name is a combination of two of Charles Dickens' characters, because I knew there was something very Dickensian about her. And once I gave her a name, and her name is Dorrit Sykes from Little Dorrit and Oliver Twist, she really sprang to life. And I realized she had a story to tell. And as I did my research, I kept stumbling over things that I call Easter eggs, these wonderful things, parts of history I didn't know about. And these all came together and fleshed out her story. And it made the telling of her story parallel to Mae's very plausible, that I could tell their stories in alternating chapters. And then about halfway through, they would meet through one event and then their lives would intersect and they would affect each other's lives in ways that they just could never have anticipated.
What would you say, you know, since this was set so far back, you know, this was set in what year?
1932.
So how did the women in your book in 1932, how would you say they compare to the women today?
Well, that's a great question, Chris. Mae Marshall in 1932 is 26 or 27. She has come back from Paris, where she tried to have a career that really didn't work out very well. And she's come back to help her father with the family business, which is an orchard and a country market. And she has an idea to expand the business and take it in a new direction that she feels like can be really successful in the depths of the Depression. But it's going to require some risk and some capital. And she gets a lot of pushback, number one, from her husband, who's a hardworking lawyer, and his practice has dried up to almost nothing. His clients can't pay him. And also society at that time. In that part of the Depression, once things got that desperate, organizations like the United States Postal Service and the railroads were laying off all of their female employees and to give those jobs to men who had families to provide for. So she's got that working against her, plus, you know, sort of society's expectations for her being the wife of a lawyer. So in some ways, there are some of the same conflicts that a young working mother might face with leaving the children at home and finding childcare and things like that. And her husband works out of town, which is something I experienced early in my marriage, which was certainly a challenge when your husband's only home on the weekends and the kids are screaming for his attention. And as far as Dorrit's character being a teenager who's grown up in a Boston tenement, something like the financial crash of 1929 didn't affect her family very much. They didn't have any investments to lose. They didn't own a house to lose. They rented a tenement. But she struggles with social anxiety. I think that that is relatable today. You know, that still happens.
Definitely.
At teenagers and young girls sort of looking for an identity. And the difference between then and now are that there were virtually no treatments for anxiety and barely even had a name then. Her mother calls it the fidgets and tells her to pray about it. So
this concept of you introducing anxiety as an issue in the 30s, because you don't really think about that. You know, anxiety is something we talk about all the time. I've suffered from it at times. Children and friends and family have. And it's something that's been there as long as I've been an adult. I've known it was there, but I've never thought about it. But it existed in the 30s. It existed in other times. And I'm interested to see how your characters handle it and manage those symptoms when no one's really willing to say, this is a legitimate condition. We're going to legitimize that those symptoms really are physiological.
Yeah, that's a good point, Chris. As I did with my first novel, I sent a list of questions to my family doctor about medical issues that I would be dealing with in the book. And in this book, In All Good Faith, I wanted to know about treatments for diphtheria and typhoid. And my family doctor loaned me a physician's reference from 1934. And I used it as the sole supply of every medical treatment, medical views of the day. And it was most enlightening. So in the novel, Dorrit finds this book at the Boston Public Library, and she tries to diagnose her anxiety and understand it and figure out a way to make herself better. And when I read this book, the category of mental disease has three pages of small print, but it's all edited by the very aptly named Dr. Wise. And it was really amazing what they said about anxiety and mental disease. It said, sex is another important factor. To mate with a member of the opposite sex is the natural destiny of the sexually mature individual, and the frustration of this design may occasion mental disorder. The incidence of insanity is considerably greater among the unmarried. Insanity is also more common among those who have been widowed. So, kind of information a 16-year-old is finding at the library about, you know, her anxiety attacks. But what she comes up with is sort of a series of rituals. And this is all very personal for me. I've had anxiety and panic attacks since I was a young teen, and I didn't know what to call it until I think I was in my 30s. So she knows that there are sort of precursors to two attacks starting, and she has a set of rituals, counting things, and mental games she plays to sort of try to put them off. The other thing she does is she escapes into reading. The library, the beautiful, beautiful building, the Boston Public Library, is her source of beauty and inspiration and quiet and learning. And she is very much enthralled with Nancy Drew. These books had just started coming out in 1930. And Nancy Drew is the same age as she is. But Nancy has two best friends, maybe three best friends, and she has her own car. And she drives around and solves mysteries and has adventures. And on one, her father loans Nancy a loaded revolver to take with her. I think that that's still in the modernized versions. But Dorrit identifies with Nancy Drew. Nancy Drew doesn't have anxiety. And Nancy's sort of Dorrit's alter ego. Parts of the book, until she really has sort of an epiphany, she's kind of wondering, what would Nancy Drew do in any given situation?
Give her a little bracelet.
WWND.
And you bring up a good point, because you were talking earlier about when you were raising your children and all that. And I know just from reading your bio, and you and I have something in common in the our writing career came as like chapter two. If our life was in parts, we would maybe be in part two or part three when our writing career took off, when our children were grown. And when did you know that you were a writer?
Oh, Chris, I'm like the ultra late bloomer. I didn't take a writing class until I was 54, I think. When my youngest daughter went to boarding school and was gone, I went back to school to study English literature. I was interested in maybe getting a second degree. I just was enjoying taking the classes. And at some point, once I committed to getting that degree, there were two classes offered in one semester that were requirements, and one was a writing class. That was when I started writing my first novel. I'd never tried to write. I've always been an avid reader, and I've appreciated good writing, I think, in literature, but never tried it. And once I did try, I found I really enjoyed it. And I certainly didn't start out thinking I would ever finish a book or have a novel published. That was far from my mind. I just found it was an interesting creative outlet, and I started taking more classes, and then I had a couple of stories published, and I realized I did want to learn more about being a writer. So I applied for an MFA program when I was 56 and finished it at 58. It was a low residency program at Vermont College of Fine Arts. I loved, oh my goodness, I just loved it. They had a lovely cohort, all different ages. I was not the oldest person either. So I finished. And while I was in that program, I signed with my first literary agent and also broke up with my first literary agent.
As it happens. Yeah.
As it happens.
Not in common.
Through the whole query process again, to find another agent. And then by that time, I had finished my second manuscript, which was In All Good Faith. It was my master's thesis. My agent called. He had my first book on submission, and he called me and said, I have an offer on your book. And I said, wow, really? And he said, yeah. And I told him, you have another book too. And I said, yeah. And he said, and they want them both. So that was, I mean, if you'd asked me, I don't know, 5 years before I'd ever be in that circumstance, I'd have laughed because I didn't expect to be here. But it's great. I love it. I feel really, really grateful to, at the age of 61, that I have something that continues to really inspire me, and I'm passionate about it, and I want to keep going and see where it will lead me. I didn't want to be one of those women who has stopped working and, you know, is no longer a soccer mom and is just waiting to be a grandmother. Don't get me wrong, and I love...
made their own lives too.
Exactly.
I hear all the time from authors who say you need to read in your genre and around your genre, and that's how you learn. And I think it's very interesting that you were a consummate reader before you ever entertained the idea of becoming a writer. Wanted to be a writer since I was a little kid, but wasn't until I was an adult, I was like, oh, I need to be reading more. So it's kind of the opposite. What a great reward for you that you had done all this reading and then you performed so well and great. Because what is the award that you won?
I won a prize of the San Miguel de Allende Writing Festival. I won their fiction contest for a short story.
And then you were a 2018
Thorndon.
Yes.
That is the greatest thing. I recommend that highly. If you can get away for an entire month at a castle in Scotland, it was like a fairy tale, Chris. It really was. You send off pages to apply, and there's a long application that you send by snail mail. And I was chosen. They have 5 or 6 writers every month, but maybe 8 months of the year, who stay in this castle with a chef. They do your laundry, they tidy your room, they pick you up at the airport. All you have to do is get to the Edinburgh airport, and it's about half an hour outside of Edinburgh in Lasswade, Scotland. And it overlooks a river, and it is as gorgeous and romantic. Here's the trick, though. They really want you to work. You're really discouraged from leaving, and there is no talking in the castle between 9:30 in the morning and 6:30 at night. So at 6:30 at night, the 5 of us were busting out of our rooms, holding out the wine bottles, saying, okay, it's cocktail time. That's why I really finished my second book, and I made wonderful friendships with the other writers who were there, and we followed each other's careers, and I'll be able to apply to go back after 5 years.
I'm curious, you know, you think about authors that are going to go to a castle to write. You think they're probably writing poetry, literary fiction, or historical fiction. Were there writers outside of those genres that participated?
It was interesting. We had one Scottish novelist, two American novelists, an American playwright who was 23 years old and brilliant, and then a young man who was 25, maybe, who had written a very quirky series of short stories that have been published. So they get a real mixed bag, and from all over the world. So it really was very interesting. But getting back to what you were saying about reading and books, I always, when I'm writing about historical fiction, I read a lot of books that were written during the era I'm writing about the 20s. I read F. Scott Fitzgerald, et cetera. Then in the 30s, I read like Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath, for instance. You get a really good idea for the speech patterns, which of course vary from area to area, depending on where in the country you're writing about, where in the world you're writing about. Magazines of the day, contemporaneous books to the period I'm writing about, always give me a much better idea of the flow of language and the slang and things like that.
Very interesting. I'm taking some notes here for thinking about a project I'm working on. You mentioned that you had an agent early in your career, and then you had another agent. The two agents that you mentioned that you had, you had two different querying processes. What was different about the way you queried the second time?
Oh, that's a good question. The first agent took me on, she really teased me along in sort of a fairy tale way we hear about people getting their agents. I sent the query letter out with the sample pages as requested, maybe 10 pages. And I came home on Christmas Eve after Christmas Eve dinner, and there was an email from her saying, I'd like to keep reading. Would you send me the rest of your manuscript? You know, I was like, oh, this is Christmas. What happened was she offered me a revise and resubmit status exclusively, meaning I could not query anyone else as long as I was changing my manuscript using her ideas. And I said, fair enough. It's a good agency. She's a well-respected agent. And that went on for, I thought I'd go like one round of revisions and then boom, I'd have a contract. Not so. 11 months later, we were starting to disagree because I was in my MFA program. I felt like my writing was evolving in ways that I was happy about. I wasn't the same writer she had started working with, and she wasn't happy with where I wanted to take the book. And we realized we really couldn't continue down the same path. So we broke up amicably. I still have tremendous respect for her. To answer your question, when I started querying again, I debated whether I should say right up front that I had been agented. But since that manuscript had never been sent out to editors, I was in a good place. If it had gone out to editors and been rejected, and then I was trying to sell it again with another agent, that gets pretty tricky. So it had not gone out. I was lucky there, polished it up, sent some query letters, signed on with a new agent. And the difference was that if I didn't put that I'd been agented in my query the second time around, if an agent got back and wanted the manuscript or wanted to read more, I would then say, just so you know, I was formerly represented by another agency and we parted on good terms, just to be completely upfront and clear. So I knew more the second time what to expect. The first time around, I had an agent email me literally 6 minutes after I sent the query letter saying, I can't wait to read this. And of course, I about fell on the floor. She had gone to University of Virginia Law School, which is right here around where I live in Albemarle County. And then it took her 4 months of silence to get back to me and say, I didn't really connect with your character or, you know, something like that. So the second time I knew to expect those long, long waits with no news. And I knew that having an agent ask to read your entire manuscript didn't mean anything until it meant something. I think I was just more realistic. I wasn't cynical. I was more realistic. And then what I didn't know from the first time around was that once your manuscript then goes out on submission to editors, to publishing houses, that is like, I mean, sending query letters is fraught with anxiety and you have to thicken your skin because you're going to get a lot of rejections. But when it goes out to the publishing houses and you know that a no is a no, you don't get to try, you don't get to revise and try it again, that it's your toast with them. That was really, really the scary part. I had to actually wrestle with the concept that this book I had worked so hard on might have gotten this far through two agents and being sent out and it might just die right here and not sell. And all the time, you know, and writers just put those manuscripts in a drawer and start another book. And that whole thought was just sort of overwhelming, because I guess I just had not let myself think about that possibility.
Well, you put your heart into it, and then it's just nauseating thinking no one's ever going to know this story. And it's
right.
A story to share.
The other thing I didn't know until I got a contract was how harrowing pre-publication edits could be with your publishing editor, that there's going to be a lot of compromising. For me, it was going back in and looking at the story when I hadn't had my hands in it for almost a year. In a way, I was really grateful to look at it with fresh eyes and to take some good advice on refining it. It certainly isn't a done deal once you get a book offer.
That's just the beginning.
Yeah.
What do you do when you're not writing?
Well, before COVID, I loved to travel. I love to, and I actually have a trip to France planned for mid-September. Fingers crossed I'll be able to go. And I'm a big gardener, love get out and dig in the dirt. And I'm a big knitter. I love doing any kind of needlework. And during quarantine, I decided that one of my projects would be to use up all my stash of knitting yarn. And so I started knitting little animals for the children in my life. Then I started posing them and taking pictures and putting them on my Instagram and telling little stories about them that ended up having chapters and more characters. And now that turned into a children's book project. So now on Instagram, it's Tiny Fox Story, and Tiny Fox has a children's book out on submission with my literary agent right now.
Oh, that's great. What surprised you most about the writing life?
I didn't realize how vulnerable I would feel. And that comes from someone who, as I told you earlier, has some anxiety issues. But, you know, when you take a writing class and you have a teacher who will be giving you kind criticism, and you have a cohort or a workshop group that will give you, you know, their views on your work, that's something you can kind of live with and accept it or reject it. Once I saw my first book listed on Amazon, my heart just stopped, because I thought, oh my goodness, strangers are going to read it and write what they think about it, whether it's good or bad, or they like it or they hate it. They can put it out there for all the world to see. And this sounds kind of simplistic, but really that feeling of vulnerability, like sending your toddler across a busy intersection naked and you just have to stand there and watch it go and see what happens. I would say that's the biggest surprise.
I have to say, I agree with you. I had somebody comment, I've had deep reviews, I don't have that many reviews, but I heard somebody comment, the only character they could relate to in my first book was a dog named Walter Cronkite.
I don't look. Usually, if I'm feeling in a really tough, strong place, I'll have a little quick look. But in the beginning, when the reviews first started coming in, I was sort of obsessive and checking how many stars I had and stuff like that. And I realized I'm going to internalize it all way too much. And it's better if I just don't look.
Please don't guess this question. In your view, what is good writing?
In my own taste, I tend to go more toward literary fiction. And honestly, I think my favorite books were written 100 or more years ago. I love Dickens and the Brontes. I love the beautiful arrangement of words and vocabularies that are creative and beautiful without being sort of ostentatious. When I was growing up, I loved historical children's books like Little Princess and The Secret Garden. And I think I had this real yearning to be an abandoned English orphan as a child. And I would come home every day and watch Dark Shadows on TV. I don't know if you know about Dark Shadows. Yeah. And then going into my teen years, that changed from loving Frances Hodgson's Burnett's books to loving Jane Eyre and the Austen books and things like that. And I'll read the same book over and over or listen to the same audio multiple times.
I do the same thing, especially audiobooks. I'm an audiobook girl. I love
it. Me too.
It's a good audiobook. I will go back and listen to it again.
Yeah. What are you listening to now?
Right now, I'm listening to The Tiger Mom's Tale, Lynn Liao Butler. I've saved it because Lynn's a friend of mine and started to read the ARC, and I stopped because I wanted to listen to the audiobook. So I haven't had the occasion to be in a car very much lately. So I save it for when I go out and check my garden and things. I will listen.
Yeah.
to a little more, kind of piece it out. At night, I read Sarah Penner's The Lost Apothecary. So that's had my attention lately. Really good. What are you reading right now?
I just finished listening to Kristen Hannah's The Four Winds. It's a very, very good audiobook. And now I'm listening to The Unlikely Pilgrimage of Harold Fry. It's sort of a British, I don't want to say comedy of manners, but beautiful, beautiful language and writing. By my bed, I have Stephanie Dre's The Women of Chateau Lafayette. I haven't gotten very far into that, but I'm looking forward to reading that.
What's the best writing advice you've received?
Be tenacious, be persistent. And also, this comes from my experience in agenting, stand up for your writing. If somebody's really trying to push you in a direction that doesn't feel genuine to your style or your characters, then you don't always have to take the criticism you get or the advice that you get to heart if it doesn't feel like it serves your writing.
Thank you so much for spending time with us today. We look forward to reading In All Good Faith. Is it in audio as well?
It is in audio. I haven't heard it yet, but it is. Both of them are. Thank you so much for having me, Chris. I really enjoyed talking to you.
For more information about Liza, visit LizaNashTaylor.com. Music by Pavel Yudin and photography by Casey Meineke. If you like what you're hearing, hit the subscribe button and consider leaving a review.